And where he is attending his final group of eight economic summit. Over the next 3 days, the president and leaders of seven other major industrial nations will deal with such world problems as climate change and a struggling economy. Mr. Bush held a series of one-on-one meetings with summit partners in advance of the meeting. Following talks with Japan's prime minister, he defended moves to take North Korea off the list of nations that sponsor terrorism. He also defended his decision to attend next month's opening ceremonies of the Beijing Olympics. He said a boycott would be an affront to the Chinese people. The president also cast doubt on Japan's hopes of a summit agreement to cut greenhouse emissions by 50% by the year 2050. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from PBS, featuring their new series inspired by Car Talk, Click and Clacks as the Wrench Turns, premiering Wednesday night on most PBS stations.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It is part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910. Support for programs comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings every Saturday from 2 to 6, and beer and spirit tastings on Sundays from 3 to 5. Information at thecorkscrew.com.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about an event that is very important in the history of the United States and China. And it took place 35 years ago last month. This was in 1972, when Richard Nixon became the first American president to visit China. The meeting came about because both sides had objectives that they were hoping to achieve. Each side had their own, and then there were objectives that they shared in common. Both sides knew that in staging this meeting, they were taking a huge gamble because if things went badly, it would be a very, very serious setback for the relationship between the two countries. This morning, we'll be getting the story of this historic meeting, talk a little bit about what it meant for the two countries and for the world. And our guest for the program is Margaret McMillan. She is the author of a recently published book that's titled Nixon and Mao, The Week That Changed the World. And that subtitle is a quote from Richard Nixon. He referred to this trip and this meeting as The Week That Changed the World. The book is recently published. It's out from Random House. Margaret McMillan is the provost of Trinity College and professor of history at the University of Toronto. And this summer will be taking up the position of warden at St. Anthony's College in Oxford. She has written other books as well as one that preceded this, that is Paris 1919, which won a number of important awards, including the Governor General's Literary Award for Nonfiction. That's one of the big literary awards in Canada. It was also selected by the editors of the New York Times as one of the best books of 2002. Professor McMillan, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us.
Oh, I'm very pleased to be able to do it.
This came about, this trip came about certainly in large part because of the two principals, Nixon and Mao. And certainly on the Chinese side, this would not, if Mao Zedong hadn't wanted this to happen, it wouldn't. But on the American side, I think there are probably a lot of people who would think or would believe that the chief architect of this would have been Henry Kissinger. When in fact, on the American side, the driving force here truly was Richard Nixon.
That's what I certainly think. And I think the whole Nixon visit to China in 1972 is one of those moments in history where it really does make a difference who's in office. I mean, it doesn't always. Sometimes things happen anyway, and there are all sorts of great events in history which happen because forces are pushing them that way. But I really think in this case, it took Mao Zedong and Richard Nixon to make it happen. Mao Zedong was clearly the supreme power in China and the final arbiter of Chinese foreign policy. And Richard Nixon had decided, even before he became president, that he wanted to put an end to that long period where the United States and China had nothing to do with each other.
Hmm. Why did Nixon think that it was important for that to work on rebuilding, to establish this more positive relationship, at least to the point where there was talking between the governments of the United States and of the PRC?
I think he had a number of motives. One, I think he just, like a lot of people by this time, was concluding that it was absurd that the United States and China, two very large countries, and the United States probably the major world power at the time, and China the world's most populous nation, didn't have any formal relationship. I mean, it seemed increasingly absurd. I mean, yes, China was a communist country, but so was the Soviet Union, and so were lots of other countries in the world, yet the United States had relations with them. I think also Nixon wanted a means of putting more pressure on the Soviet Union to negotiate things like arms control. And I think particularly in his mind was Vietnam. Vietnam overshadowed his presidency in its first term as it had overshadowed the Johnson presidency. And Nixon dearly wanted to get the United States out of Vietnam, and he hoped that one of the ways to do this would be to persuade the Chinese communists to put pressure on their friends, the North Vietnamese communists. And so he saw an opening to China as suiting all sorts of needs of the United States and helping to further the interests of the United States.
Yeah. So as you say, clearly, as far as the United States were concerned and President Nixon was concerned, that one of the things that he was hoping was that in establishing a better relationship with China, that would help, that China would be in a position to put some sort of pressure on the North Vietnamese to get them to the table and to have more favorable terms so the United States could get out of Vietnam. On the Chinese side, what the Chinese apparently, among other things, maybe primarily were interested in, they were interested in Taiwan. And apparently they were hoping that perhaps they could persuade the United States essentially to give up Taiwan so that the Chinese could do what they're still hoping to do, and that is have control of Taiwan, make Taiwan part of China again, which, of course, they always have thought that Taiwan was part of China and still is.
You know, this is the whole Taiwan issue. I think Nixon and Kissinger didn't realize at first how central it was to Chinese thinking, but they certainly came to realize it. I mean, for the Chinese communists, Taiwan should be a part of China. It always had been a part of China, although I think there's certainly a lot of room to debate that particular issue. And not having Taiwan as part of China was, to the Chinese communists, a sort of incomplete recovery of all China's national territory. And that's why it's still a big issue today. I mean, they see Taiwan from Beijing as something that should be part of China, and they see it as having this quasi-independent status as something that is an insult to China. It's an insult to Chinese nationalism. So, yes, for the Chinese communists and during the Nixon time, Taiwan was absolutely central.
And one thing that so each side had at least these big specific issues that they were concerned about. For China, it was Taiwan. For the United States, it was Vietnam. There was, and you mentioned it, also something that they both were interested in, and that was, in a sense, to make the Soviet Union uncomfortable. They wanted the leaders in the Kremlin to see Nixon and Mao shaking hands, and for them to feel that this was a potential, this alliance, they wanted the Soviets to feel that this alliance between the United States and China was a potential threat for them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's nothing something that will help to bring people together is a common enemy. And both the United States and the People's Republic of China had their own reasons for wanting to put pressure on the Soviet Union and wanting to make the Soviet Union sit up and take notice of them. And the United States had been involved in negotiations with the Soviet Union over arms control and various other agreements, and the Soviets weren't showing much willingness to negotiate very fast. And the Soviet Union, of course, was supporting the North Vietnamese and other enemies of the United States around the world. And for the Chinese, the Soviet Union were even more than to the United States, I think, a very real threat. There had, in fact, been fighting along the common border between China and the Soviet Union in 1969. And the Chinese were very apprehensive about the Soviets possibly doing a sneak nuclear attack on them. And so for both China and the United States, a friendship with the other would give them a card to play against the Soviet Union.
Well, then you talked about the fact that the Chinese were concerned about the possibility of a significant attack from Russia, that actually the Russians had floated that idea with the United States. They had said, I'm not sure in what way or how formally, but that the Russians had tried this out on America and said sort of to the effect, you know, if we dropped a couple bombs on China, would that bother you?
Exactly. Yeah. No, I mean, it was extraordinary. It was all done. It wasn't done at any official level, so there's no piece of paper coming from Moscow saying, by the way, we're thinking of dropping a few bombs. But it was more or less at the level of, you know, a Soviet diplomat would sort of sidle up to an American diplomat at a cocktail party and say, you know, just asking, but would you mind if we dropped a few bombs on China? And the Chinese certainly were getting wind of this. I mean, it wasn't that much of a secret that the Soviets were beginning to think like this.
Yeah. Even I would imagine, I would hope that the reaction from the United States side was that they were horrified that the Soviets were even mentioning it, even in an off-the-cuff sort of way.
Oh, no, the United States was absolutely horrified and let the Soviets know, in I think very firmly, that the United States didn't regard the casual use of nuclear weapons as anything that was desirable. And, you know, it always, I mean, if you start using nuclear weapons, there's always a danger of World War III. And there were all the issues with fallout. And a lot of the fallout, if the Soviets had bombed China with nuclear weapons, the fallout would have blown over the United States. So there were all sorts of reasons why the United States thought it was a really bad idea.
Mm. Well, and was there some point even before the meeting that the United States and Richard Nixon specifically actually said in so many words that the security of the People's Republic of China is something that's of concern to us?
Yes, there was a moment in 1971, for example, when towards the end of 1971, India and Pakistan got into a war, and there was real apprehension in Washington that the Chinese might be tempted to intervene to protect their friend and ally of Pakistan against India, because the Indians were winning the war. And the fear then was that the Soviet Union might intervene to support India. And the United States, Richard Nixon did say publicly, and I think various members of his administration had said it on other occasions, that the United States takes the continued existence of the People's Republic of China very seriously. I forget the actual words they used, but they made it clear. They didn't say they would come to China's defense. The United States would come to China's defense, but they made it quite clear that the United States didn't want to see anything threatening the independence of China.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Margaret McMillan. She is a diplomatic historian. She's professor of history at University of Toronto and is the author of a recently published book, Nixon and Mao, The Week That Changed the World. It's published by Random House and does indeed tell the story about the Nixon visit to China in 1972. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit about the fact that on the American side, the driving force behind this was Nixon. What did Henry Kissinger think about the idea of Nixon's going to China?
Well, as far as we know from the evidence, not very much. I mean, he himself in his memoirs doesn't, of course, admit this, but there are other people at the time said when Nixon took office in 69 and said to Kissinger, who was his national security advisor, I want to try and get an opening to China, Kissinger's initial reaction apparently was, I think the president's gone nuts. He wants to recognize Red China. But Kissinger was and is a very intelligent man with a great sense of how the world works, and I think he recognized that Nixon was serious. And I think he also saw, once he began to reflect on it, just how sensible it was or would be if the United States could get some sort of opening to China and how much advantage the United States could gain from that. And so in the end, Henry Kissinger was going to play an extremely important part in helping to broker the very delicate negotiations which established the first contacts with China.
And afterwards, I think it was, though, important. There perhaps was some jockeying for who was going to get the credit for this. It seemed like it was very important to Richard Nixon that he get the credit for this.
Well, I think both people wanted the credit. I mean, it was, you know, it's one of the good news stories that come out of this period. I mean, Vietnam is not particularly a good news story, even though Nixon and Kissinger eventually helped to get the United States out of Vietnam. But there are a number of setbacks for American foreign policy in this period. And the opening to China is really an act of statesmanship, which puts the United States in a stronger position and establishes a relationship which is very important. And so I can understand why they both would really want to take the credit for it. My own view is that Nixon deserves most of the credit. And, of course, from Nixon's point of view, particularly after Watergate, to be able to remember the China opening was perhaps something, you know, particularly important for him, because it helped him to forget about all the shame and humiliation of Watergate.
Yeah, and it's worth remembering, I suppose, that it was only 2 years after this that Nixon resigned and was out of office, and then just 4 years, it was 1976, Mao Zedong died. So
yeah.
It wasn't really that, it wasn't all that long after this historic high point that one man was dead and the other man was no longer president.
No, and in fact, about 4 months after Nixon's very successful visit to China in February 1972, the Watergate burglary took place. And, of course, at the time it wasn't much of a sensation, but it gradually all began to unravel in Nixon's second term.
Visits like this don't just happen. There obviously has to be a lot of groundwork laid to prepare for it to happen in the first place. And certainly that was a place where Henry Kissinger and many other people, I'm sure, were very important. And this is a big part of the story. Can you just talk a little bit about what it took, what was involved in arranging for this visit to take place?
It was a very complicated process, and lots of moments where it really could have gone off the rails and the whole thing might not have happened. In the first place, it was very difficult for both sides, even though they both independently were thinking it would be a good idea to talk to each other, to make it happen. I mean, if you haven't been talking since 1949, and if you've been actually saying very rude things publicly about each other, you can't suddenly turn around and say, you know, we didn't mean it, let's talk, because you don't know how the other side is going to react. And so what had to be done was to find a way of reassuring the Chinese if you were American, or reassuring the Americans if you were Chinese, that you were actually changing your thinking. And so they began sending out rather subtle signals. The Chinese, for example, stopped talking about Nixon as a sort of bloodsucker and began to talk about him more politely as President Nixon. And Nixon began to talk about the People's Republic of China and not Red China, which is how he'd always referred to it. But what also happened is Nixon began to leave word with various statesmen around the world whom he knew were on good terms with China, saying, look, please tell them, I'm really serious, I want to talk. And finally a channel was opened up through Pakistan, which was on good terms with both sides, and a very, very secret channel where messages would be carried through Pakistan saying, look, the Chinese really would like to talk to you, and then a message would go back from Washington again through Pakistan saying, okay, we'll send someone, and that's how it really began to be worked out. And then in the summer of 1971, Henry Kissinger paid his famous secret trip, which really set things going towards the Nixon visit.
So this was early in the first time, apparently, Nixon ever said to Kissinger that he wanted to improve relations with China. This was early in 1969.
Yep.
So this to happen, it took, 2 years before it actually occurred.
Yeah, it took 2 years. And, of course, there were bumps on the way because the Americans were still involved in Vietnam, and so they bombed in Cambodia, for example, in the spring, the Easter bombings of 1970, and the Chinese who were supporting North Vietnam took that very badly. And so there were difficulties, but I think both sides continued to inch towards talking to each other. And then when Kissinger made his secret trip in July 1971 and it became public, then it became easier to actually begin to talk about the details of what Nixon's trip would be like. But even then, it was tricky because you have two very proud nations, and there were all sorts of issues about, for example, who would fly Nixon's airplane, Air Force One, once it was in China. Would it be American pilots or would it be Chinese? What sort of car would Nixon ride in? What presents would each side give the other? I mean, all these things, which in retrospect don't seem that important, were in fact very important at the time.
And there seemed to be so much, even once the thing was set and they decided they were going to go, there was uncertainty. Nobody really knew how it was going to go. In fact, I think that it's true. When Nixon went, he didn't even know if Mao would meet with him.
No, this is where I really take my hat off to President Nixon. I mean, he really, I think, behaved in quite a daring and statesmanlike way. I mean, the Chinese had said, yes, there will be a meeting with Mao, but nothing had been set. And that was partly, actually, although the Americans didn't know, because Mao had been very sick. But nothing had been set when Nixon got on the plane in Washington at Andrews Air Force Base and took off. And I think it was brave of him, because if the Chinese had said, sorry, you can't see Mao, it would have really hurt Nixon back home in the U.S. I mean, people would have said, our president went all the way to China and got humiliated. And so it was a gamble. What Nixon also worried about was that the supporters of Taiwan, who mostly came from the conservative right in the United States, would really make life difficult for him, and he was worried there'd be a huge public outcry about his even going to China. In fact, that didn't happen, but again, he wasn't to know it until after the trip was over.
Hmm. Well, you know, obviously people are familiar with the derivation of the expression Nixon going to China, and about the idea that it would have taken someone who had such a firm reputation as being an ardent anti-communist to be able to do this. At the same time, what was there? Did he pay a price in support of conservatives in the United States who maybe thought it shouldn't have happened, or that if it was going to happen, they should have come here rather than him going there? That it was there was too much of a It was too much of a bow in the direction of the whole thing was too much of a bow in the direction of the Chinese?
Not at the time. I mean, in fact, the reaction from the right was surprisingly muted in the United States during the Nixon visit and just afterwards. There were a few people who objected, William F. Buckley, for example, Pat Buchanan, who was working in the White House at the time, but really not all that much of a public outcry. Most people seem to have thought, you know, this is good for the United States. Our president is establishing an important relationship. Later on, you certainly did get people saying, you know, perhaps Nixon shouldn't have gone, perhaps the Chinese should have come to Washington. Did he go too much as a supplicant to the old Middle Kingdom, which was the name the Chinese had for themselves? But that really was later. I mean, I don't think at the time, and certainly before the Nixon visit, really I've looked through the records, there's very little suggestion that we're showing a sign of weakness by going to China and we should be getting them to come here. I think what Nixon was enthralled by was the idea of him going to China, the first American president ever to do it. And so it was only in retrospect and later on that people said, oh, maybe he shouldn't have gone, the Chinese should have come here. But I don't think the Chinese would have come to the United States, not in those days. I think Mao was too sick to travel, doubtful if he would have let Zhou Enlai go. And I think really Nixon showed himself to be very statesmanlike in going to China.
And they only spent an hour together.
Nixon and Mao had an hour together. The day Nixon arrived in Beijing, and when he got off the plane and he was riding into the city with Zhou Enlai, who was the Chinese prime minister and Mao's right-hand man, Nixon said, when am I going to see Mao? And Zhou said, well, not today because it's too early and you want to rest and so on. But Mao was absolutely beside himself with excitement and kept on phoning Zhou Enlai and saying, I want to see him. I insist on seeing him today. And so Zhou Enlai comes back to Nixon's villa where he's dropped him off and says, actually, President Mao would like to see you about 4 o'clock this afternoon. And so off they went. And Mao and Nixon talked for about an hour through interpreters, of course. And my view is they didn't say that much. The conversation was rather rambling, and it talked a lot in generalities. And you can see Nixon from the transcript. Nixon keeps on trying to get it back on track, and he has all sorts of serious issues he wants to talk about. And Mao keeps on saying, no, let's not worry about that. But I think the important thing about that meeting is that it took place.
That seems to be the bottom line for understanding this whole thing. We talked earlier about the fact that the United States and China each had specific objectives. There was the one that they had in common was that they were seeking an ally against the Soviet Union. That, at least in terms of the two big things, what the United States wanted, that is help in getting out of Vietnam, and for China, they wanted to get Taiwan back. Neither of those things happened. So you have to say, well, the immediate objectives might not have been realized. But there again, as you say, that perhaps the most important thing about this event was not so much what was negotiated, what was said. It was the fact that it happened at all.
I think I agree with you. I mean, it was a diplomatic revolution. I mean, suddenly what had been a bipolar Cold War, for example, between the United States and its allies and the Soviet Union and its allies becomes something much more complicated. It's now a triangle, and it's a different sort of Cold War. It really is quite different. And the fact that the United States and China have established a relationship means an awful lot of difference in Asia as well, not always to the pleasure of some of American allies there. I mean, Japan was taken aback by the whole thing, as were a number of other American allies. I think Nixon's own rhetoric, the week that changed the world, may be a bit too strong. I mean, you can't blame him for saying it. But I do think it's a very important moment. And what that week-long visit does, with all the pictures, you know, for example, of Zhou Enlai, the Chinese prime minister, and President Nixon toasting each other at a big banquet, what that week shows is that the United States and China now have a relationship. And that becomes a factor which really everyone else in the world has to take into account.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Margaret McMillan. She is professor of history at the University of Toronto, and this summer she will take up the position of warden of St. Anthony's College in Oxford. She's a diplomatic historian. She has authored the book Paris 1919, which won a number of awards. New York Times considered it one of the best books of 2002. Among the awards, it won the Governor General's Literary Award for Nonfiction, which is a very prestigious award in Canada. Her new book is Nixon and Mao, The Week That Changed the World, and that subtitle is indeed a quote from Richard Nixon. That was what it was his assessment of this event. He said this was the week that changed the world. The book is out just recently. It's published by Random House. Questions are welcome. We do have one ready to go, and others, if you'd like to join the conversation, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There's a caller here in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hello. I just turned in a few minutes ago, so you may have covered this earlier, and I'm sorry if you did. But did you talk about the role of ping pong diplomacy and what that played in preparation for this visit?
No, I didn't, but I'm glad you asked me about it because it's a lovely story. What I was talking about before you tuned in was the way in which both the United States and China were trying to send signals to each other that they really did want to have a new sort of relationship other than the old, cold, hostile one. And in the spring of 1971, there was a table tennis tournament in Japan, and the Chinese sent a team for the first time in a number of years, and there was an American team there among lots of other countries. And Mao sent the Chinese team with very strict instructions that if the Americans speak to you, be polite, but don't go out of your way to be too friendly to them. And, you know, clearly the Chinese were sort of feeling their way, but an American player missed his bus back to the hotel and saw a bus sitting there from the practice hall, and so jumped on it, filled with Chinese players. It was a Chinese team bus, and there was consternation in the Chinese officials, but one of the famous Chinese players, the sort of world champion, sort of beckoned to the Americans, said, come and sit beside me, and they, too, sort of tried to chat through sign language. Anyway, this was reported back to Mao, and Mao said, good. This Chinese player did the right thing. Let's invite the American table tennis team to come to China and play in a little tournament there. And so suddenly this American table tennis team, I mean, they were mostly teenagers, sort of high school kids and college kids, found themselves the first official Americans to go to China since 1949 and found themselves at the center of this sort of diplomatic event. And so the American table tennis team went off to China and played a number of games. The Chinese apparently were told to let the Americans win some because the Chinese were really sort of, you know, leading the world in table tennis. And there was a big sort of reception in the Great Hall of the People in Beijing, right in the center of Beijing, and Zhou Enlai, the Chinese Prime Minister, toasted the American table tennis players and said, you know, here's to the continued friendship of our two peoples. And so it was a very, very important signal being sent by the Chinese to the United States that really they wanted to behave in a different way and that things were changing.
Was Kissinger already involved in preparations for the other visit?
Oh, absolutely. Kissinger was planning his own secret visit, in fact, and a number of things were happening both sort of publicly and behind the scenes, but the invitation to the table tennis team was certainly seen back in Washington as a very encouraging sign, and the reception that Zhou Enlai gave for them and the toast that he made, was all of this was seen as really encouraging. You know, the Chinese are really going out of their way to show us that they want to improve the relationship.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to King Kiki for a caller right here on our toll-free line. Hello.
As we recollect this meeting of the President of the United States and the leader of China, cannot we but reflect that we could learn something about the conduct of our foreign relations from that meeting? Would the guest be willing to speculate on what a similar meeting between the President of the United States and the leader of Iraq or the leader of North Korea might accomplish?
It's a very good question, and it's it's a very interesting one. I mean, I think sometimes you have to be prepared to talk to people who you may not much like, you may disapprove of their systems, but when you have interests at stake and when they have interests which may overlap with your interests, it seems to me to make sense to try and reach out to them. And I think the parallel situation today, North Korea possibly, but I would think even more Iran. The United States doesn't want to see chaos in Iraq and doesn't want to see an unstable Middle East. And Iran doesn't want chaos right on its doorstep and doesn't, I think, want to see chaos in the Middle East. I think at least they have that in common, although they have very different outlooks on many other things. And I think that there is a lot of argument to be said, or a lot of reason to say, that the leader of the United States and the leader of Iran, or the leaders of Iran, should speak to each other. I'm not sure it's going to happen anytime soon. I'm not sure that there's much political will in either Washington or Tehran for it to happen. And in the end, I think, even though it sometimes seems sensible for countries to talk to each other, you've got to have the leadership that wants to do it.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Joe, you talked about the fact that as the visit was being planned here in the United States, that Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, they kept this very close. Who in the United States government knew that this was in the works?
very, very few people, mostly Nixon and Kissinger and people who worked for Kissinger in the National Security Council, some of whom had come from the State Department, but the State Department itself didn't know about it. Nixon and Kissinger believed that the overtures to China were so delicate that they had to be kept very secret. They were very concerned that there'd be leaks in the press, and they felt that if the whole very early stage of the negotiations, before Kissinger had made his secret trip to China, became public knowledge, the Chinese might well get spooked and sort of cut the whole thing off, and they didn't want that to happen, and they didn't want a sort of political furore in the United States. They also, I think both Nixon and Kissinger, didn't like the State Department much anyway. Kissinger saw it as a rival in foreign policy to himself, and he wanted to be the chief U.S. foreign policy person, carrying, you know, dealing with President Nixon and helping him to carry out American foreign policy. And they saw the State Department, I think both of them, as something that was cumbersome, bureaucratic, leaky. You couldn't trust them with secrets. This may or may not have been true, but that's certainly how they saw it. I think, furthermore, I think both Nixon and Kissinger had a sort of predisposition to be secretive. They both liked having secrets. They both tended not to trust other people very much. So I think all together, partly for very practical reasons, partly because they didn't like or trust the State Department, and also I think perhaps because they tended to like being secretive anyway, they kept the negotiations with China very secret indeed.
How did the Secretary of State feel about the fact that he was not in the loop on this?
The Secretary of State, William Rogers, I think, was very unhappy about it. I mean, he didn't know that Kissinger had gone to China and Kissinger was on his way there, and then Nixon told him. And so he really was kept out of the loop. I mean, this you know, he's kept out of the loop from the beginning of the Nixon presidency until the summer of 1971 when Kissinger made his famous secret trip. And I think he was hurt. I think he felt humiliated, and he was going to be further humiliated during the Nixon trip to China when he was kept out of all the important negotiations, wasn't taken along to the meeting with Chairman Mao, with the meeting between Mao and Nixon. But he was a very dignified man and a very loyal man and felt that it would be unseemly to say so publicly and would damage the administration, and he had signed on to be the Secretary of State. And so I think he behaved in a very decent manner. There was certainly the State Department. Many of the people in the State Department were outraged. They felt not only was the Secretary of State being badly treated, but they felt the whole State Department was being badly treated. And I think a lot of them felt a real annoyance at this and a real animosity towards Henry Kissinger in particular, who they saw as intervening to get the ear of the president and keep the State Department marginalized.
And as you mentioned in the first half of the conversation, the United States certainly didn't let any of our allies know. And when the trip, the news of the trip was announced, in some foreign governments, there was a great deal of consternation. I think the Japanese were particularly unhappy. The British were unhappy. What was the reaction among those governments that were close to the United States?
Well, I think there was a feeling that they really should have been kept a little bit better informed. I mean, the whole overture between the opening up the overtures between the United States and China and Kissinger's secret trip became public knowledge when Nixon went on television the day after Kissinger got back from China and announced that Kissinger had been to China and that he, Nixon, would be going. And I think the Japanese government was given half an hour warning that Nixon would be making a speech, and other governments got about the same amount of warning. And I think there was real shock. Edward Heath, the Prime Minister of Britain, was quite hurt because he thought he had a good relationship with Nixon. And it is said that he never really trusted Nixon again, and that he was one of the things that persuaded him that the Great Britain should begin to turn more towards the European Union and try and get into it. The Japanese had already had a couple of shocks, and that's when that word shoku entered the Japanese language. They'd already had a couple of shocks from Nixon, and this was just another one. And I think they were very, very upset. And at that point, a number of Japanese statesmen and diplomats began to start thinking that the very close relationship that Japan had with the United States maybe was a bit too close, and maybe Japan should start to look out for its own interests. The Taiwanese, of course, the government in Taiwan, were absolutely shattered. They perhaps should have seen it coming, but they apparently didn't, and they were very taken aback, and there was a bit of wild talk in Taiwan about how they were going to create an incident by bombing something in China. Or there was even talk that they might try and shoot down Nixon's plane on the way to China. That didn't happen. But I think it's an indication of just how taken aback people were. In countries like Malaya, Indonesia, Imelda Marcos apparently was absolutely in a fury and got on the next plane pretty well to Beijing and went off to try and you know, open up her own relationship and the Philippines' own relationship with them. So, no, I think it really did shock a lot of American allies.
We are now, the lines have just filled up, so we'll try to get in everybody. We have only about 15 minutes left. Callers will help us by being brief. Let's go to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was interested in the guest's comment that Henry Kissinger said initially he thought that President Nixon was nuts. And that was, I wonder if people are aware that is literal. And that isn't the only time Kissinger thought that Nixon was insane or something close to that, because he told Woodward and Bernstein for their book The Final Days that he thought Nixon at the end before he was forced from office and was talking to paintings and on his knees crying and so forth, that he was crazy. Yeah. And that's one thing I'd like you to address. And the other is this the period of time when Nixon was using Dilantin off-label, the anti-seizure drug, which is it's an illegal use of it, by the way. And thirdly, wouldn't this all be an argument for psychological and drug testing for presidents?
Oh, dear. I'm a Canadian. I'm not going to get into that. I don't know about the Dilantin. I've never heard of it. And I've read quite a few biographies of President Nixon. So, you know, as far as I know, there wasn't I haven't seen it confirmed. I mean, the president who does seem to have used a tremendous cocktail of different drugs for his various ailments was President Kennedy, who was actually, in some ways, his health was much shakier than appeared at the time. I don't think Nixon was crazy, and certainly when Kissinger said, I think the president is nuts to want to talk to Red China, that was just a figure of speech. But I think certainly in the last days before Nixon resigned, he was under tremendous pressure. Everything he'd worked for was sort of crumbling, and I think he was reacting very emotionally, as I suppose any of us would under such pressure. But, you know, Kissinger used to say dreadful things about Nixon the whole time. He was always very, very critical of him. And what is interesting is that Nixon very rarely said anything rude about Kissinger like that. I mean, he knew that Kissinger was saying things about him. He said at one point, that's Henry, I know he's like that. I mean, what can I say? You know, he likes to go off and gossip with people and tell them funny stories. And I think perhaps, you know, it is possible that the descriptions of Nixon in the last days are a bit exaggerated. But, yes, he was under tremendous pressure because of Watergate.
All right, let's talk with someone else here. Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Hi, I think I share the latter assessment. I mean, but when you have an official policy called the Madman Theory of War, where you fly a B-52 over threatening to bomb Vietnam with a nuclear weapon, you know, that kind of makes it policy that you're mad. But I didn't want to dwell on that. At the very beginning of the show, you emphasized that China was going to be used by Nixon to intervene with Vietnam. I find that to be totally absurd. Vietnam and China were historic enemies, and they actually went to war some years after the U.S. pulled out. So it could only be seen, as the host mentioned, that as a tripartite, you know, strategy of uniting against Russia, which was actively helping in Vietnam, and we were actually bombing some of their ships in the Haiphong Harbor at some point during the Vietnam era. So it just seems to me that sort of undercuts some of the diplomatic analysis. William Rogers was in St. Louis area just before the announcement of the China visit, and I attended a conference that he spoke at, and I don't think he was that blindsided. I don't know when he officially knew something was up, but he knew that he was not in the inner circle from early on. So I don't know. I don't know how you'll react to that, but I just find this
Perhaps I can pick up on two of your comments.
I'm not being very diplomatic, but go ahead, please.
No, let me pick up on two of your comments. William Rogers, like everyone, knew that there was a thaw happening between the United States and the People's Republic of China. I mean, that was clear. But what he didn't know about was the high-level secret negotiations between the Nixon White House and the Chinese communist leadership. As far as the American hope that China would put pressure on North Vietnam, we mustn't read back into, yes, China and Vietnam went to war at the end of the 1970s, but we mustn't read that back into the early 1970s. China, and a lot of this has come out since the end of the Cold War, was in fact a major supplier of weapons and all sorts of other support to North Vietnam. In fact, there were a considerable number, at one point over 100,000 Chinese troops in North Vietnam doing such things as training the North Vietnamese in using anti-aircraft guns and helping to build roads and railways for them. And so the Chinese were, in fact, a major patron of North Vietnam and were very, very important in the North Vietnamese war effort. And the United States was quite right in thinking, or at least in hoping, that if they could establish a relationship with China, they might be able to persuade the Chinese, perhaps in return for concessions elsewhere, to put pressure on North Vietnam. And in their discussions in China, both Nixon and Kissinger returned to that repeatedly, asking the Chinese to intervene, to put pressure on the North Vietnamese, to negotiate in good faith with the Americans. And so, yes, although the Chinese and the Vietnamese have historically been enemies, in this case they were actually working together very, very closely.
There was another point you wanted to address?
Oh, the madman theory, I guess. Because you have the madman theory, which is quite interesting, and Nixon and others have talked about it, was that if you are trying to bring your opponents around to perhaps negotiate with you or to a more reasonable frame of mind, if they think you're crazy, they might think twice before they continue to mess with you. And that's what Nixon was talking about with the madman theory, and it goes back before Nixon. I mean, it was discussed in academic circles that if your opponents think that you are totally unpredictable, then they may treat you with more respect because they just might be terrified about what you might do. And so because you hold such a theory doesn't mean you're a madman yourself. It means that you are thinking of using a strategy which might really intimidate your opponents.
It's kind of odd to classify that under diplomatic history, though, because it actually highlights the point that the guy that released the Pentagon Papers,
Ellsberg,
mentioned that the U.S. has actually used nuclear weapons multiple times since Hiroshima. You use a loaded gun by pointing it at somebody's head, even if you don't fire it. So much for diplomacy. Thank you.
Well, I think in diplomacy, people use all sorts of different tactics. Diplomacy is not just about being polite. It's about trying to get what you want. And it's like any sort of negotiation. You'll get rough and tough if you think it's going to help you, and you'll be nice and kind if you think it's going to help you as well.
There was an agreement signed by Nixon and Mao, the Shanghai communique, and this was something that was engineered and negotiated by Kissinger on the one side and his people, and Zhou Enlai on the other. And one thing that I thought was particularly interesting was in their discussions about what it is they should be talking about and what should be in this agreement, that Kissinger said to the Chinese that he thought it was a waste of time for them to talk about trade.
Yeah.
And that he said that in their economies, any trade that there would be between the two nations would be negligible, which is, of course, today, it is enormous, the amount of trade between the two countries. And yet I think I was just very struck by the fact that Kissinger thought it wasn't even important. They didn't even need to be talking about it because it mattered so little.
It is funny, isn't it? I mean, I guess we should all be careful what we say because sometimes our words come back to haunt us. I think it's true to say that neither President Nixon nor Henry Kissinger were that much interested in economic issues or trade. And Kissinger said very dismissively when he and Nixon went to China, we'll let the State Department have their discussions with the Chinese and they can talk about those sort of boring things that they like, such as trade and cultural exchanges. But yeah, looking back, trade is hugely important. I mean, the trade between the United States and China today is absolutely vast. And of course, there's a real worry in the United States about the imbalance of trade because the Chinese are exporting an awful lot more to the United States than the United States is exporting to China. The same thing on cultural and academic exchanges. I mean, in fact, one of the things that really helped the Chinese to take off in economic terms after Mao's death was that so many young Chinese came to the United States to be trained. And in the end, quite a lot of Americans went to China and attended university there and even taught there. So economics and culture turned out to be very important in the long run.
One individual here who was very important, we really haven't talked very much about, was Zhou Enlai, who was the number two man in the government of China, of the PRC, and who was very important, as I said, in making the agreement and negotiating with Kissinger. Zhou Enlai was the person who did it. He was the point man. Would you want to talk a little bit about him?
Yeah, Zhou Enlai was very important. I mean, he was one of the great survivors in Chinese Communist Party history, which is something, because that party had some pretty nasty intra-party fights, and if you were on the wrong side of the fight, you generally disappeared from the scene pretty quickly, often quite literally. And Zhou Enlai had always shown an instinct for knowing when to switch sides and knowing who to ally himself with, and he had survived by being close to Mao, and he'd also survived being close to Mao, because it was dangerous to get too close to Mao, because Mao didn't like rivals. Zhou Enlai was not only a great survivor, he was Mao's right-hand man. I mean, I think without Zhou Enlai, China would have been in much worse shape because of Mao's increasingly bizarre policies, and Zhou Enlai sort of helped to hold the whole show together. He also was a master diplomat, I mean, an extraordinary figure, and he really did the day-to-day work on the Nixon trip and the opening to the United States. Mao remained in sort of seclusion, rather like an emperor of old, and gave the general directive and signed off on anything. But Mao didn't do any of the day-to-day negotiations or any of the day-to-day work himself. That really was Zhou Enlai. So Zhou Enlai was absolutely vital in the whole trips coming about and in the final success of that trip.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple minutes left here. We have one caller at least I want to get here in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hello. Would you care to comment on the present situation? It seems to me that China has been the obstacle to peace in Darfur, and they thereby permitting the genocide. So on the one hand, we have the possibility, if we would trade less with China, disengage from China, we would weaken their power, and therefore it would be easier to get into Darfur and correct that situation. But on the other hand, there's a school of thought which would be if you engage them politically and economically, there's the chance that they will subvert it by capitalism.
It's very tricky, isn't it? And there's a big debate at the moment, and I'm not sure I know the answer myself, but there's often in the past as well been a debate about how to deal with China or to deal with other regimes whom you don't always approve of and who do things you don't always like. And is it better to get tough with them, running the danger that they might begin to build themselves up militarily and become more difficult and become more aggressive, or should you try and engage them and bring them into the world? And I think it's a very, very important debate, and I'm not sure where I stand on it. I think it's one that is a very live debate at the moment, and there are a number of new books and articles coming out on this. What is the best policy for the United States towards China? There are many things the Chinese do that the United States doesn't approve of. Darfur is a very good example. The Chinese have blocked really serious action in the Sudan. Human rights is another issue, which a lot of Americans and certainly a lot of Canadians take very seriously. Should you let the Chinese know when you think they're behaving badly? Or do you run the risk of making them more suspicious, more prickly, more determined, which they've just done to up their military spending? And as I say, I'm not sure I have an answer, but it's a very important question, and it's one I think we all need to take very seriously.
Well, what as one thinks about the potential for China in the future, I certainly think that it is widely regarded as being a potentially one of the most powerful countries in the world. And I suppose as the Chinese are concerned, they think that they once were, and in a way they still are. I think that they're well aware of their long history and the fact that China at various times has been a world power. In what way do you think about China and its future in global politics?
Well, again, it's a very important question and one difficult at the moment to gauge. I mean, the one scenario is that China becomes much more powerful and becomes the great rival to the United States in Asia and the world. It keeps up its military spending, its rate of growth keeps up, it continues to be ruled by a very strong one-party government. That's the sort of pessimistic scenario. The other scenario is that China doesn't ever get to be quite that strong, that its internal problems, of which there are many, the rapid pace of development has left a lot of people behind. There's a lot of strain in Chinese society. The party itself, I think, in many ways seems to be running out of steam and is becoming increasingly a vehicle for simply getting ahead. And can that really hold the country together? And will the rate of growth keep up? Will there be real problems in China? And will China find itself in a state where it's having to deal with huge internal problems and less able to project its power abroad? And there are a whole range of scenarios somewhere in between there. I mean, I think my own sense is that we shouldn't overestimate the potential future power of China. I mean, it's going to be an important regional power, but it's got a long way to go before it's anything like the military power that the United States is or the economic power. And in the meantime, it's got an awful lot of problems and issues at home, which are really, I think, in the long run, going to hamper it.
Mm. Well, and just in, as a way of concluding, as a result of your having spent a lot of time looking carefully at this history and perhaps taking advantage of some sources that previous historians might not have had, was there anything that you felt was particularly surprising or something that you would have said that you hadn't known or was not widely known about this time and this event?
I think most of the sort of general picture was pretty widely known, although some of the material from the period has just recently been declassified, and there's still more coming out on the Chinese side. I think what I hadn't realized, although in fact it was, the evidence was there, and I could have realized it earlier, was just how much top-secret classified information Nixon and Kissinger handed over to the Chinese, and that surprised me. And just in general terms, what surprised me, and again, this is there in the public record, was really just what a great statesman Nixon could be, and I think was, particularly in the case of China.
Well, at that, we will have to stop because we've here to the end of our time. If you'd like to read more, and certainly there is more in the book, a more detailed account of this meeting of Nixon and Mao Zedong in 1972, look for the book. It's titled Nixon and Mao, The Week That Changed the World, published by Random House, by our guest, Margaret McMillan. She is provost of Trinity College and professor of history at University of Toronto, and this summer will be taking up the position of warden of St. Anthony's College in Oxford. Professor McMillan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign, the Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infant-parent.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where the bears have been solidly in control of the marketplace on this day. The market's being pressured by good rains over the weekend, as well as the potential for good growing conditions across the corn and soybean belts for the next 2 weeks. Market also being pressured by outside market forces today, including a stronger U.S. dollar and a U.S. oil's futures pit, which has seen drops of more than $4 in the early trade today. Meanwhile, this morning, USDA said that 18.411 million bushels of U.S. wheat were inspected for export in the latest week. That was within the range of trading estimates for 15 million to 20 million bushels. The corn number this week for the export inspection at 32.422, also within the range of trading of 30 million to 35 million, the estimate from traders earlier in the week. And in the beans, the USDA export inspections were at 9.095 million bushels, and that again, as in the case with the wheat and the corn, within the range of trade, the traders expecting anywhere between 8 million and 12 million bushels of beans to be inspected for export this particular week. Let's go ahead and look at the trade as it stands right now in Kansas City. July wheat at 8.49, down 56. September, 8.57 and one half, down 54 and three quarters. July wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, not trading. The September, 8.27 and a half, down 60. December, 8.51, down 59 and a quarter. July corn, 6.94, down 52. Of course, that's in delivery and is reflecting of the current cash price. September, 7.27 and three quarters, down the limit at 30. December at 7.47, also down the limit at 30 as well. July beans, 15.79, down 79, also in delivery and the cash price. The August through the November are all limit down, 70 down at the moment, locked at that position. August at 15.79, September 15.67 and a quarter, and November at 15.61. July soybean meal 4.31, down 19.50. July soybean oil 64.88, down.